Shall we try chapter 8?
Yes.
We've completed the king's address. The king was calling the people of Galilee, the region that went dark first in Old Testament times, back under divine kingship. He was announcing good news that the reign of God was being restored. And without saying, yes, and I'm king, he's proclaiming this in a way that makes people think, wow, what authority does he carry? The very next chapter, Matthew takes us into a whole series of stories that address that very question. What authority does he carry? It's all about his authority. And the authority of the king is what transforms the whole community. The first story is about a leper. You know much about lepers? Contagious skin disease. We have something that we call leprosy today. What they call leprosy with them is probably broader than just what we name as leprosy. But the key idea was that this is a spreading skin disease. It spreads over your body. Anyone else who comes in contact with you, physical touch, is likely to transmit it to the community. Because it spread, it was one of the uncleannesses that was really dangerous back in Old Testament times. So if you read in Leviticus, there's a lot of things that make somebody unclean. If you touch a dead body, you're unclean. You can go wash and then you're clean. But if you get leprosy, you can't just go wash and be clean. Like, you still have this thing and it spreads, and everything you touch then becomes unclean. And so you can't actually be in the community. So you were quarantined.
Like COVID.
From the community, so nobody got the horrible thing that you've got. And so lepers would live in these little hovels with other lepers, but they couldn't hug their kids. They couldn't be part of the family celebrations. They were not allowed to be. If anyone came near them, they had to call out unclean, unclean. Leviticus 14 gives you the background for all this. So when a leper comes and kneels before him and approaches the king, anyone reading the story back in New Testament times will be going, he shouldn't be doing that. A leper has no right to approach royalty. This is horrific. But this guy is so desperate to be cleansed from this defilement that is keeping him out of the community that he says to the king, if you are willing, you are able to cleanse me. Now, this has got both physical and spiritual connection. Bear in mind, in the culture we're talking about here, they didn't understand germs, they didn't have hospitals with disinfectants. What was unclean kind of blurred the line between what was medically horrible. You hear nasty things about lepers, you know, as if their limbs fall off. They don't fall off. What happens is that leprosy stops you feeling, the nerves don't feel anymore. And so while you're asleep, a rat will come and eat your finger off.
Oh.
Right. It was gross. People were disfigured and scared of this. So it was both spiritually and emotionally and physically repulsive. And you don't let this guy anywhere near the king. And he says, if you will, you can make me clean. He's asking to be declared clean of this disease, but also clean as far as the community is concerned, so he can turn up at mum's birthday tomorrow, or, you know, whatever the family get-together is. And what Jesus does is unbelievable. Jesus' response as the king seeing this person in need is not, stay away, stay away, you'll make me unclean too. Jesus reaches out and touches the guy. Now, according to Leviticus 14, anything that a leper touches is unclean. So if Jesus reaches out and touches him, is Jesus now unclean? Everybody who saw this happening was asking that question. But what Jesus says is not, I am now unclean. What Jesus says is, you are now clean. So somehow the world is running backwards. If you find a rotten apple in your fridge, you don't go, oh, let me push all the other apples around it and see if it can make it clean.
Exactly.
It doesn't work that way.
No.
So if the world is being cleansed from Jesus' touch instead of Jesus being made clean, it's the world's running backwards. Mm-hmm. Everything that is defiled, everything that is wrong is now starting to be set right.
Yeah.
And you can see it in what the king has just done with this guy. So the goal then is ultimately that the world becomes cleansed under King Jesus, because he has the authority to do that. And no one else has had the authority to cleanse the earth. That gets picked up in stories later on. It gets picked up in the final book of the Bible, that the earth is cleansed and it's all become clean space. In Jewish thinking, the temple was the clean space. Yeah, the holy space. And there was the holy of the most clean space of all. And no one with leprosy or any kind of contagious disease was allowed to go into that. It was holy space. And at the end of Revelation, there's no temple. And John's scratching his head, why is that a temple? Oh, I understand, there's no defiled space. The temple was the holiest space in a defiled world. But if the whole world is clean, then you don't need one space. You say that the whole thing is clean. Like, that's where Jesus is taking us. And this is the first little taste of the ultimate cleansing of the entire world under Jesus' authority. And very often Jesus tells people, don't go and tell anybody. He tells this guy that. I've never been quite sure how the guy was meant to be able to do this. Imagine he does turn up at his mum's birthday party tomorrow and they're going, but you're not allowed in here. And he goes, guess what? What's he going to say? Oh, sorry, I'm out of here. Like, there's no way he can't. I don't even know if Jesus meant this long term, but what he wants him to do is, before he goes home, before he goes and hugs his kids, before he does all the things he's just desperate to do, before any of that, I want you to go to the temple and I want you to show yourself to the priest the way that Leviticus 14 talks about, and offer the sacrifice that you're meant to offer as a gift to God in gratitude for what's just been happening. Because I would very much like the people in the temple to know that this is happening in the community. So Jesus does want the temple to know that the temple won't be the only clean space. Cleansing of the world has begun by the one who God has provided for us. All right, that's the first example of authority off scale. We never expected it. The second one is an officer in the Roman army. He has a servant who's at home. His houseboy is sick. And don't miss the point that this guy is unable to move and cannot be brought to Jesus. Now, in this moment, Jesus has got a problem. Is he really being asked to go inside this Gentile's home? Unclean space. Gentiles ate non-kosher food. Gentiles didn't wash after they touched a dead body or a leper. The whole house is effectively unclean for a Jew. And so Jesus' question is, are you asking me to come inside your house? You can't bring the guy to me. He's paralyzed. He can't be moved. Are you serious? And the guy, no, I don't expect you to come inside. I'm not a suitable person to have you under my roof. I'm not clean in that sense. I'm not asking you to do that. See, I'm a soldier. And when I issue a command, people do what I say. Because the whole power of Rome stands behind me. If they don't do what I say, they'll be in more serious trouble than you can possibly imagine. I understand the authority that stands behind me. And I think I understand the authority that's behind you. You're not representing Rome. You're representing another kingdom where you have authority from heaven that has been given to you. And so all you have to do is issue the command, and whatever you decree, it has to happen. So if you wouldn't mind just issuing the command, my servant will be fine. Jesus is gobsmacked. He looks at this guy and he looks around at some of the others who were there. And I can imagine, Jesus, did you hear what he said? Do any of you understand the authority? Do you understand my authority? A non-Jew has understood the authority of heaven in ways that his own people have not yet understood. And Jesus is so shocked, surprised, amazed at this guy's understanding of his authority. He calls it faith, because faith is allegiance to authority, trust in a leader. He's so amazed at this guy's trust in his authority. Speak the word, that's fine, I'll go. That he says to them, do you realize this is just the first little taste of what's going to happen? This non-Jew, who's not even part of God's people, is already running miles ahead of the rest. And I tell you, he won't be the last. Many will come from the east and the west and sit down at Abraham's table to join in with what God has provided for the Abrahamic family, while some of the children from that family actually miss out and they're not getting this yet. And they haven't understood the authority that heaven has given to me. And so when they do get it, they'll be finding themselves out in the dark with the resentment that they've missed out. Weeping and gnashing teeth is, it's the horror of the realize, oh no, I missed it. So the inclusion of people who are not even Jewish is the authority that heaven has given to this king. Here's not merely the king of Israel. He's the king of the world. And at the end of Matthew's gospel, he will receive all authority and instruct his servants to go and bring the nations under his authority. That is the extent of Jesus' authority.
It kind of reminds you of the Magi who also got the bird.
Yes, right. Yes. Yeah. Non-Jewish people,
yeah,
got their head. Unfortunately, that has continued. So it's still today, non-Jewish people who recognize Jesus as the Messiah, mostly, with some of his own. But authority, key word, it's all about his authority.
I just have a quick question. So I understand like the main thing is authority and the centurion's understanding of that. Just a side question, I guess. In Luke, this account, like there's a few differences.
Yes.
So my question is, so in Luke, it wasn't the centurion that was speaking with Jesus. It was first the Jewish elders that the centurion sent, and then the centurion sent his friends because the centurion was thinking, oh, I'm not worthy to come to speak to you. So how do you deal these apparent inconsistencies in Scripture?
There are several places where the story is told differently in the different Gospels. All I want to say, I think, is that none of these guys are telling the whole story. Every story is abbreviated. Right. I could tell you a story about the last time a Jehovah's Witness came to my door and the conversation I had with this lady who was actually quite interested. Often they just want to push their own wheelbarrow and they don't talk right. But I ended up having quite a fascinating and respectful conversation with her. I didn't tell you there was another person there, did I? Just mentioned one. There's actually more than that. I just focused on one little part of the broader story. So if Luke says there was other people involved in this whole process, that's fine too, because each account is abbreviated and therefore different. And it might be hard for us sometimes to see how to put those things together, but every account is selective.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Oh, it's okay. And listen, I don't question the authority of the word. I just try to understand because at first it's the centurion that's speaking to Jesus directly, but then here it's other people that the centurion has sent.
Yep.
And there's other cases too, like how Judas perished.
Yeah.
You know, well, was it the hand or was it the sword or what, which one was it?
There's certainly some differences there.
Yeah,
so one of the things you can do is when you're reading a passage like this and you want to see how it reads in the other Gospels, the NIV usually has that at the top. There it is. So under the heading, the faith of the centurion, verses chapter 8, verses 5 through 13, has a parallel passage in Luke 7, verses 1 to 10. So you could go and read that. And my understanding of the story, as I'm trying to fill in the details and understand it, can be informed by what Luke has to say as well. Often handy to do that, yes.
When Jesus cured the leper, he asked the leper not to go and talk about it. Is there a reason for that?
He didn't say how long. So one possible way to read this would be, don't go home and tell anybody about it. Go straight to the temple and tell the priest about it. If you go home, start hugging your kids, you'll never get there, mate. Don't go home and talk about it. Go straight to the temple. That's one possible interpretation of it. There are other times when Jesus told people not to go and tell anybody about it, and there may be different reasons in different cases. Some of the cases where Jesus said don't talk about it was literally, it was too dangerous. There were enemies that were after him and his friends. So don't talk about it, right? Yeah. But I don't see that as being the case for this guy. So it might be, go straight to the, don't go tell anybody. Goes, I'm reading that because I can't see any other way this guy's not going to be able to talk about it. As soon as he goes home, like, how could you not? So I think it might be just a temporary thing.
If he didn't go through the temple, he could be in danger because he just runs into society and his stomach could take him out.
Yeah, at this stage, the temple or the priest may not be that much aware of Jesus because we're still fairly early in the story. So he may not be in danger yet. That could come back. Yeah.
But sure. I'm just thinking the fact that people assume he's a leper, don't know he's been healed, and suddenly he's running around, he could be running a risk.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
It makes sense for him to go and go through the ritual of being declared clean.
Getting his certificate.
Yep, that's right.
Yep, definitely. Beautiful. So we've seen two examples of Jesus' authority. The third one is more generic. Jesus came to Peter's house. Did you know Peter had a house?
Well, Peter had a mother-in-law as well.
There he is. Peter's mother-in-law was like... So Peter had a house. He had a wife. He had a mother-in-law. Yeah, if you go to Capernaum today, there's a house that belonged to a fisherman, and they'll tell you this is Peter's house, whether it actually is or not. We can't be absolutely certain because that wasn't identified right back in the very beginning. But, okay, Peter had a house. His mother-in-law is lying in bed with a fever. He touched her hand, the fever loose. She got up and waits on him. And the point is that when everyone sees her well, it causes a stampede. That evening, many who were demonized were brought to him. He drove out the evil spirit just with a word, healed the sick. Matthew says, this is fulfilling what the prophet Isaiah said. He took up our infirmities and carried away our afflictions. It's more than just disease. It's all kinds of afflictions, which would include like mental states, mental health, physical health, spiritual health, emotional, you know, the whole range of stuff Jesus took on himself. Man, how are we doing for time? Better not go into detail. I would love to give you the background from that text in Isaiah. It's a quote from chapter 53. Isaiah 53, you may be familiar to some of you. But you've really got to read the whole context from Isaiah 40 to 56, basically. That entire section is the story of the suffering servant. And Jesus becomes the king who becomes the servant who takes away the suffering of his people, ultimately by wearing that on the cross himself. That's the short version. So taking up the infirmities of his people, the afflictions, the pain of his people, and making it like taking it himself becomes the paradigm for what we're called to do, to take people's burdens, hearts, sobs, brokenness, frustrations, anguish, sickness, the whole. We take that because that's what our King has done for us. What a way to use your authority. Then there's this cute little story which I absolutely love. It wasn't that often that one of the Pharisees or the teachers of the law, the scribes, came to Jesus and said, I want to follow you. So this is a good day. And Jesus' response to the guy is, oh, that's amazing. We were just trying to talk with Peter and John about how we could create some seeker-friendly meetings and have some nice music and you could come and you could follow. He doesn't say that. He makes it hard for the guy. Do you realize what you're getting yourself into? You want to follow me, but if you're following me, you won't have anything. Animals and birds have places to rest. I've got nowhere to put my head. In the context of talking about Jesus' authority, I think this is a contrast with someone like King Herod. Herod had luxurious palaces with very nice beds where he could lay his head. He had fortifications where he could run to be safe if his people were against him. Those of you who went to Israel with us would probably have seen Masada, This is just the very tip of Masada. It's absolutely enormous. In the Judean wilderness, there's an entire platform way up high that Herod built this fortification on top, and he could run there if the Jewish people were ever against him. And he had a place to be safe, a place to put his head. And Jesus says, if you're walking with me, you won't have anywhere to put your head. He calls himself the Son of Man. Have we talked about that? In the beginning, God gave humans dominion over creation to look after the birds of the air and the foxes and the animals and the creatures on the earth and in the sea, and to have dominion. So if the human descendant, that's what Son of Man means, if the descendant of humanity has nowhere to lay his head while the birds and the animals have got places, something wrong with creation, something wrong with the world. But Jesus has come as the inheritor of what God promised to humanity, the heir, the son of humanity, to regain that spiritual authority for the peoples of the earth. Does that right everything that's wrong? So the Son of Man is doing that. But he's not doing that by acting like Herod, building himself a nice palace, nice fortification to be safe. He's doing that by walking the hills of Galilee, finding people that are suffering, fixing what's wrong for them, playing the servant role with nothing for himself. Now, since this is the program, are you sure you want to follow me? Maybe we should do that more often. Did you really want to become the servant of humanity? Because that's the sort of King Jesus, that's how he uses the dominion given to humanity to become the servant of everybody. And there can't be any higher priority. The guy who says, let me go and bury my father, doesn't sound like a very unreasonable request, does it? On the Jewish scale of things, burying a relative, especially a father, is kind of like the top priority. And Jesus says, nah, I've got your priorities right here. So we might have to rethink what he meant when he said, seek first the kingdom of God. There's no other priorities to your life. Jesus is intentionally challenging people about how they use their lives, because the king who has all the authority is using his life as the servant of everybody. That's a different way to use authority. So if that's what the king does, then that's what the citizens of the kingdom have to do too. Calming the storm. What a staggering example of divine authority. Herod claimed to rule Galilee. Pilate had Judea, and nobody had the sea, because nobody rules the sea. Australia claims we own, 200 kilometres off coast or something. And China claims, the nations claim a little bit close to their land, but honestly, no one owns the oceans. The sea is unruled and unruly. And on this particular occasion, the guys are out there rowing across the lake and the sea gets rough. Because it's sort of like a bowl shape, it can get winds that roar through there. That's not like that most of the time, but it can do. And these guys who are fishermen and are quite used to being able to handle this stuff are terrified. And they're thinking, we're going to drown. And Jesus is asleep in the middle of all that stuff, because he doesn't have anywhere to lay his head, right? So he's taken advantage of a moment, being rocked in a boat, trying to catch a bit of shadow. And he gets up, rebukes the wind, and that's amusing, isn't it? Wind, waves, stop it. Tells them off. And suddenly it's completely calm. And the disciples are going, now I'll have to row. No, the disciples are going, what kind of person is this? That's about his authority. If he has authority over not just the land, like Herod and Pilate, not just over the earth, but over the sea as well. We've never heard of anybody who had that kind of authority. Oh, yes, we have. There was a day when Israel was stuck between the mountains and the Red Sea. And God made a way through the sea, right? The Lord reigns over this. This is a divine authority. This is not like earthly authority. This is divine authority. What kind of person is this? Someone with divine authority. That's the point. And the final story is on the opposite side of the sea. Let's see if we've got that little map. There you go. There were 10 towns called the Decapolis. Only one of them was on the same side of the river as Galilee. All the others are on the opposite side. So Jesus has gone over into the area near Gadara, this region. Different word in the different Gospels, in case you're wondering about that, Adam. But they're sort of, he went over to, one of the Gospels says this, different one says that.
Oh, okay, yep.
But it's the same area. Yep. So it's not a contradiction. It's like, just, it's a general area where this took place. And they're in this Gentile space. You know that because there's people running pig herds, right? There's no one in Capernaum that was running pig herds because there was no market for pork. This is Gentile territory that they're in. And here in this unclean space are these two characters living in the most unclean places of all, the tombs, with all the powers of death that are there in these tombs. And these guys seem to be attracted to that. So they've got unclean spirits within them, in the unclean tombs, in the unclean Gentiles. It's like, this is horror stuff. And the text says that no one went that way because they were so violent. And Jesus leads the disciples through there and ends up in conversation with these two guys. The demons call Jesus out. What are you coming, talking us? You don't have authority to kick us out now. Have you come here before the appointed time to torture us? So they're recognizing that Jesus has the authority as the heir of the heavenly sovereign, the son of the eternal king in the earthly realm, but he doesn't have that authority yet. That's still to come. So they're arguing a technical point of law to say, Jesus, you shouldn't be doing this. Now, there's literally no point arguing with liars. So Jesus doesn't even bother engaging the conversation or proving his point. They notice they're in a pretty desperate situation and they offer to accept pigs. Now, for any Jewish person who hears this story, it proves how gross these spirits are if they'd be happy to live in a pig. And Jesus says, all right, have the pigs. You can't have the humans. And the pigs can't cope with it. A couple of thousand pigs. Anyone here been a pig farmer? My dad was a pig farmer for a while. 2,000 pigs is worth quite a bit. It's worth significant, it's a big herd, right? And 2,000 pigs rush down the slope and these two men are whole. They go back to town and tell the people, we've lost our pigs. What do you mean you've lost the pigs? Well, they're drowned. And the people in town don't know what to do with someone who consider him in being free from that kind of a spiritual power, that spiritual oppression. But they're not happy with losing their pigs. They tell Jesus, we don't want you here. You're a Jewish prophet coming into Gentile territory and destroying our pigs? We don't want you here. Get out. Now, for me, the most interesting part of the whole story is what Jesus does in response to that request. They pleaded with him to leave their region. So Jesus stepped into a boat, he left. This is the guy who has all the authority from heaven over earthly diseases, earthly authorities, the sea, and the spiritual realm. Every dimension of life he could possibly imagine. And when people say, don't want you, he just leaves. I bet if Caesar had turned up at that town, they said, we don't want you to get lost.
He wouldn't have gone lost.
Yeah. It would not have gone well.
No.
So even though Jesus has this authority, the way he uses his authority is not to force himself on people. It's to free people from every kind of oppression, affliction, every threat against human life. But he only does that where he's welcome. That is a very different authority to what we imagine. So if we're going to be telling people that Jesus is the heaven-appointed Christ to set right everything that's been wrong on earth, we're going to have to do that in a way that communicates he's not trying to dominate you. I'm blown away that he would just say, all right, not welcome here, I'll head back. Still meditating on how he uses his authority. So different to what we imagine.
Why did he permit the demons to go into the pigs? Like, why not just cast them away and leave it there?
What do you think? Didn't tell us. So what do you think?
I have no clue.
It was one way of getting it over fast. Just getting it dealt with. It certainly implies his values. Two people, 2,000 pigs, easy one.
Yeah.
Certainly implies values like that. Different to the values of the pig herders.
Yeah. Okay. So it could have been like a little lesson inside of a lesson.
Values are there for sure. Thank you. I think that will draw it to a close for tonight. In preparation for next week, we'll read the next two chapters, chapter 9 and 10. If you're thinking about this in slightly different ways to what you have when you read it before, then we're expanding your understanding. That's what we're praying to do. See you next time.